Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, we have on the line Clive Chen. Clive, are you there?
Yes, my brother. I'm right here, live and direct.
Well, let me just tell you what I found just last night, Clive. I was thinking about the interview today, and I'm going through my tapes, and I look, and I said, oh, man. I just found this interview from 1998, July of 98, and a great interview. I mean, what information you had on that interview? The problem was that my voice sounded very, very muffled. We have things secure here now, so the listeners can hear both of us with clarity. And I want to say, Clive, what have you been doing since? And that was 8 years ago, brother. So what have you been doing lately?
1998.
Yeah,
man. Yeah, it's a good while.
Time flying, man.
Yeah, you remember that. Yeah, well, I've been pretty much active, you know, still within the business framework. You know, I've been still compiling compilations for various reggae labels, you know, like Soul Jazz, Blood and Fire, Pressure Sounds, and recently one with a label named Motion, and they're all based in England.
Ah. Yeah. Now, is Motion the label that you did with Lynn Tate and the Jets? Was that Motion?
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah. Okay. That was on Motion.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Out on a Funky Trip.
Right.
Yeah, other than that, you know, I've been doing other little things, like I've been reissuing some Revival 7-inches for my collectors out there on the Impact label, and also I've done a five-color set on the Randy's Ska stuff from the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple other interested collectors, like the Count Machuki single called Pepper Pot. I just had that one reissued just a month ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And you're still working with...
pretty active, you know, plus, you know,
Working with Jammy Land, still
working? Pardon?
You're still working with Jammy Land?
No, I'm pretty much doing that myself.
Okay.
Independently on my own, you know?
Okay. Well, that sounds good to me, Clive, because I know you have a wealth of music stored up there and stuff that people haven't even heard, you know? So I know, and you've been doing it from that time. And
right. And
as I was listening to that interview, Clive, I said, this is almost like another generation coming out. It's new listeners need to know about Clive Chen. And so let's go back and talk about the beginnings, Clive. And for listeners that may not be aware of you or, you know, VP Records or Randy's, can you tell us a little bit about where it all began?
Well, it all began for me back in 1968 when I first, you know, got introduced to the recording end of it through my father recording studio at 17 North Parade, Kingston, Jamaica. But before that, you know, I was pretty much aware of the recording industry because my dad set up Randy's recording studio and record shop back in the early 60s. Used to take me around to different venues, different recording studios, and also occasionally I would meet his artists and musicians when they come to our residence up in Vineyardtown.
Mm-hmm.
We live on Deanery Road in Vineyardtown.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was aware of all these things pretty much as a lad, you know, until I was old enough to step into the studio and start doing my own recording in 1968. And, you know, it blossomed for me from there on. You know, I had the opportunity to work with some real giants in the music industry. You know, just to name a few, Augustus Pablo, Dennis Brown, John Holt, Ken Boot, Delroy Wilson, Orton Celis, you know, numerous And groups like Heptones, the Gladiators, the Ethiopians, you know, the Slickers. You know, I was blessed, put it that way, to have that opportunity and a first hand coming into the business and, you know, blossom from there for me, you know, until I came to the United States in the late 70s. And from there on, you know, we developed a small record shop on Jamaica Avenue in 1967. No, sorry, in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
77, sorry. I'm getting the years mixed up now. It's been so long. But, yeah, you know, we started out a small record retail shop in Jamaica Avenue back in the summer of 1977, and it was called the VP Records.
I remember that
now
place.
Now the leading reggae label in, should we say, the world? Yeah, I know for the United States, but I'm not quite sure for the world.
It's out there.
We've been around.
It's there. They've been out there for quite a while, man. And I just want to say, give thanks for VP Records, you know, and the works that they have done. And also, but here's a question I have for you, Clive. Mm-hmm. With all of the, you know, being the number one distributor of reggae music in the United States and beyond, why hasn't VP ever made built a studio of its own?
I guess primarily because they saw it as a reason, because, you know, we had a studio before.
Right.
And there was no reason to not set up another one here in the States. But my whole feeling is that, being that when we came up as, you know, fresh coming in from Jamaica, we saw where we had the opportunity of licensing independent producers materials here, representing it here.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no real need to, at that time, to like say, okay, let's sign this artist or let's sign this group or let's sign this label. It was just basically a distribution setup where we would get products from like Lee Perry, Bonnie Lee, Clancy Eccles, Sonny Pottinger. So there was, at that time, there was really no need for a recording studio to be set up in New York. But as time went on, and we, in the early 90s, like I'd probably say about 1991, when we started doing the Strictly the Best compilations and the Total Recall compilations, that's when the label came into effect. That's when the birth of the label, VP, came into effect. That and then we started seeing the light to sign artists because, you know, the majors were stepping in and started signing, you know, like Shabba Ranks and Super Cat and, you know, just to name a few at that particular time.
Right.
And at that particular time, then there was really a need for a recording studio. But then, you know, artists were going back and forth doing their thing and then, you know, coming up with their own tracks. And we just decided that, you know, rather than building a studio, let's just set up a mastering studio. We do have a studio, but it's just primary to cut masters.
I see.
And we do editing, you know, like putting the tracks together there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so there was really no great need for a recording studio.
Well, the reason I asked you that question is that I was reading something about you, and I know you miss it because that was a great part of the whole thing of you being in there and creating. And, you know, I was reading about you and the late Errol Thompson now, and you know, and how you guys just were creating stuff, and, you know, it was just like beautiful. I mean, you love that because you're allowed to do that.
Right.
So, you know, that's why, you know, I was saying, well, you know, and I thought about it, and I said, well, I can imagine VPs having a studio here, you know.
Right.
But as you say, they do the mastering.
Yeah, you know, we had set up the mastering back, I believe the mastering was done around mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was around 85, 86 when the mastering studio was set up. But, you know, there was other studios around that we used. We had good relationship with HCNF out in Freeport, Long Island.
Right.
We had great works with, you know, guys like this guy in Brooklyn called again, Yard Music Production.
Big Yard?
Big Yard. No, not Big Yard. That's... That would be Robert...
Livingston.
Livingston.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
There's another guy, I think Sydney...
Sydney Mills?
Sydney Mills, yes.
That's my boy. That's my
right.
boy. Yeah,
that's true. It's somewhere out there on Church Avenue. I think it's a living room studio.
Yeah, that's Sydney, because Kevin just released it. Kevin Batchelor just released the album on that label, you know, with
Yeah, you know, there's, you know, quite a few studios around, you know, the tri-state area. And, you know, there was really no great need, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to just say that we have come a long way. We, you know, we've been around in the business pretty much over 40 years now. Well, I physically have been in the business over 30 years, 35 years, coming this year. And, you know, it's not, I would probably say it was not easy in the beginning because it was, very hard, a lot of hard work, a lot of time dedicated. You know, we had to spend numerous amount of hours a day trying to get certain things going, get labels, get, you know, records sent out to be manufactured, get a driver to distribute them on the road. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Setting up, you know, various accounts, throughout the United States.
So that's hard. That's some hard work.
But it has paid off. You know, paid off because now you can sit back and say, well, all what was being done back then, you can see that it's benefiting. You know, it's gratifying that at least it wasn't in vain.
Ah.
All that hard work was
serious thing, man. Two things I remember is where the word Randy's came from a record store in the United States, and
yes, the name was taken from a radio show that was being broadcast on the broadband in Jamaica. And I can't remember the name of the radio station, to be exact.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the program was sponsored by a record store called Randy's.
Okay.
In Nashville, Tennessee.
Ah, that's what I was trying to remember. Nashville, Tennessee. Wow.
Yeah, the store was originally from Nashville. And my father fell in love with the name, Randy's.
Uh-huh.
And he adopted the name back in the late 50s. And, you know, that's where it all sprung from, you know. That he was, you know, also called on occasionally Randy himself.
Right. Himself. Okay. So that's what, because
they call him Mr. Randy.
Okay. The next thing is that I'm gonna remind you of something you told me once, that you went to a VP function and somebody didn't know what was Randy's. Remember that?
Oh yes.
What's
they
Randy?
They couldn't affiliate the VP. With Randy's. They had no clue of what Randy's were. But, you know, because obviously, you know, it takes people like yourself that has the interest of the music, number one.
Mm-hmm.
The love, too, and the grace to make people know that, you know, this is where it's coming from. But, you know, these young guys up here nowadays, they just, you know, affiliate VP with just VP. They can't go into the roots of it to say, where did this name VP come from? You know, and a lot of people up to now still can't figure out what's the significance of VP. What does VP stand for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it can stand for many things. It could stand for yes, please. Or, I mean, very please.
Very please.
Very please, you know, as well as, you know, very special, you know.
Very positive.
Positive, exactly. You know?
But we know it's...
Actually, V is for Vincent, which is my dad. And P is for Patricia, which is my stepmom.
Uh-huh,
so
okay.
That's how the V and the P came into the equation. And primarily the reason for that is because my dad didn't want to use the name Randy's to be confused with his brother's business in Brooklyn, which at the time he had a business set up there back in the late 60s called Chin Randy's.
That's where I used to go. See, now that could have been very confusing, Clive, because that's where I used to go. So I associated that.
Yeah, well, you know, my dad actually had... his hand in that back then from the start of that business.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, Uncle Victor, he's deceased now. He was a trained technician, and he used to fix radios, televisions back then.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this little tiny repair shop on Schenectady Avenue between St. John's and Lincoln Place.
We know where that
my
is.
My father would come up in the 60s and, you know, visit his family because his other two brothers, Victor and Keith, was living there, and his sister, Daphne and Molly. And, you know, he sat them down one day and said, "Why, you know, Victor, why you just don't use that store that you're repairing all these radios and all these televisions and just put one part of it into a record shop, and I will help you. I will supply you, get records for you from Jamaica." And it so happens that my uncle took him up on the offer, and that's how, you know, my uncle started his first record shop by, you know, adding records into his technician shop. And he saw that the records was doing better than his actual servicing because
you
carry one radio there for service and you have to wait until the end of the week or the end of the month for this man to come back and pay you. While if you could sell several hundred records, and he was the only record shop that was carrying Caribbean music in the entire New York, not even in just in Brooklyn, but in entire New York.
Wow. So Moody's wasn't even up in the Bronx at that time.
No.
Right. Moody's was nowhere
Moody's
near the Bronx
and
then.
Brad yeah. and all of those guys weren't there.
Yeah.
Know? I think the only other Caribbean store that was around at the time was a store called, it was over on Utica Avenue, a store called Strikers.
Ah, I've been in there too.
This guy was from, I think, he was from
Trini?
St. Vincent.
Oh, St. Vincent, okay. Because I know he had a lot of Calypso. Vincent. He had a lot of Calypso in there.
A lot of Calypso. You know, he represented Singing Francine,
mm-hmm.
Stalin, and all those guys, you know, from them era, you know.
Yeah, Calypso man.
Calypso Pros, you know, all those legendary Calypso singers, you know.
Yes, man.
So, yeah, that was, you know, back at that time. And, I mean, it was very interesting to see how, you know, at that time, that how hungry Caribbean people were to buy their own. It's just like, you know, we traveled to another country and, you know, we're in a Caribbean community and we try to support each other. Like, you know, a baker might set up around the corner. Obviously, you're going to go and buy your bread and buy your beef patties or mm-hmm. vegetable patties, and you support them. Then you need your Jamaican newspaper, you know, to keep on top of what is happening in the island.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is how things started back then
mm-hmm.
to what it is now in this 21st century, you know. You know, you're going to Brooklyn, every corner has a jerk chicken place, every corner has a patty shop. you know, every corner has a roti shop, you know.
It's amazing, man. I miss it. I haven't been there in a while, Clive. It's amazing, man. You know, it's like, I love it. Flatbush Avenue, I know the places I'm going to check, man. And then, you know, the first time I ever saw you was in your shop.
Yeah, well, when I came up back in Leeds, I came up in 1977, you know, not for the first time, but to actually settle in, and I saw the opportunity for a Caribbean restaurant in Queens because there was none, and guess what, you know, where we were with a record shop was called Jamaica Avenue, but more fitting.
Right.
To have a record shop and a restaurant, a food shop on Jamaica Avenue.
You feel good, man. You feel like, hey, man, this ain't that far from home.
Yeah, man. And I mean, you know, when I started into that food business, boy, it kicked off so well, Charles, that we didn't have a hand to sell food.
Wow.
We didn't have a hand to sell food. I mean, if we could have opened 24/7, we could have done excellent. But, you know, it's a lot of work. It's strenuous because you got to get up early. You got to open up. You got to start cooking. You got to, you know, you end up closing late because all that cleaning up, all that pots and pans have to be washed and turned down for the following day. So it had a lot of work, and it took a big toll out of me because I did it for 8 solid years. You know, until I said, you know, boy, I don't know if I can continue this. I need to settle back in and rekindle to see where I can get myself back into the music because I was losing out on my music. You know? Although I did still got support from, you know, these guys around the place like Keith. You know, he passed away now, you know. I'm talking Keith Hudson,
yes, man.
Glenn Adams and Brown and, you know, all these guys that were in New York that would come around and support me and sit in, you know, Roland Alfonso, you know, would come in and sit in and buy him soup and, you know, we would have a chat and Ray. But, you know, all this is just phases that one's passed through life, you know what I mean?
True.
Part of the whole exodus, you know, it's a part of what I, you know, personally was involved with, you know, the music, entertainment, the food, and the love of the people, you know what I mean?
I want to ask...
I've been around some really positive people, including yourself, man.
Thank you, Clive. I want to ask you a question. It's a general question. It may be a tough question to ask. I mean, to answer. It's the state of the music today. I mean, because that's a broad statement. You know, what do you feel? Because, you know, I mean, it's probably complex because you could answer it in a lot of different ways. But in general, what do you feel the state of where the state of the music? And I'm not talking about guys making a lot of money, but in general, where the music is today.
Well, I mean, from my outlook on it, I mean, I am on the actual edge looking into the mix of everything. Because I haven't been physically or spiritually involved in any sort of recording in the industry for a good 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've helped out quite a lot on, you know, side jobs, working and doing overdubs, doing a few mixes for some young guys like the Slackers with your, you know,
my friends.
2003.
Yeah, man.
And also, you know, working with some other young guys in England on their projects, the Gold Master Group. And just to come back to what you're saying, it's like, it has come a long way. It has transparent from the early settings of the music business. You know, when I say the early settings, I'm talking the foundation, artists and musicians from the 50s and the 60s coming up. We set a foundation for these guys that are currently recording their music and currently touring with their music. But it has presently being somewhat of a little disappointment, personally to me, because I don't really and honestly see any creativity. I'm talking about their, not their lyrics so much, but their music.
Same rhythms, you mean?
Yeah,
need to change up.
And they're using the old school music and modernizing it to a fashion, but it's not their originals. In other words, they'll take a studio one rhythm, they'll sample it, they will put probably different percussions, or they might put a different drum. Well, not so much a drum. They try to capture the original drums, because the original drums, I don't see any of these new musicians mastering that.
Mm-hmm. Is that, there you go, Clive. Key words you just said, new musicians. Do you feel that is one of the reasons that we don't have enough young people that really become full-fledged musicians?
Right.
Okay.
I mean, they can play something over exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm.
They can't come up with something original of their own. You understand me? In other words, you see like how the foundation musicians, like, I'll give you one instance, like Carl Masters or Lloyd Nibbs,
mm-hmm.
or say, my personal drummer at the time when I was recording was a guy called Lloyd Adams, a.k.a. Tin Leg. Santa Davis.
Okay.
You know, which is Carlton Davis, but he's called Santa.
Santa, one of my favorite drummers too, man.
Right, from out of the old school, he's a full syndicate drummer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys would play their original drum rolls, and they'll play the symbolics at a very unique style. I mean,